From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, two school principals from Illinois, one Black and one Latina, have a podcast exploring ways to unite Black and brown people. We'll talk with them later this hour. And an update on a story we've been following. In the NCAA men's basketball tournament, Illinois and Loyola both won their first round games, but Loyola dominated Illinois to pull off an upset victory 71-58 over the Illini in the second round. Loyola will take on Oregon State Saturday afternoon in the Sweet 16. On the women's side, Bradley and Northwestern play their first round games later today. We will continue to follow that story. And now it's time for our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Today, we're focusing on state government, and I'm joined now by two reporters who follow the action closely. Sarah Manser is a reporter with Capital News Illinois, part of the Illinois Press Foundation, which provides stories to newspapers and broadcast outlets across the state. Sarah, thanks for being on with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also with me is Hannah Meisel, and I think this is the first time on this show I get to use your new title, Hannah, State House Editor for Partner Station, WUIS, NPR Illinois, and other public radio stations across the state. Hannah, congratulations, and always good to have you on.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here, Brian.
And listeners, if you have a question, ask us anything about state government. 800-222-9455 is the number to call. That's 800-222-9455. Hannah, I'm going to begin with you, and I'm going to begin with COVID-19. Late last week, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a plan to act as what he's calling a bridge to whatever version of normal we can get to. What is the deal here?
That is correct. If you'll remember last early May, in the early days, weeks of COVID, the governor announced a five-phase so-called Restore Illinois economic reopening plan. At that point, we had already been through phase one, which is, rapid spread of COVID. We were in phase two, phase three. We began phase four of this plan in July. And that's when the governor kind of retooled his plan. So we would have 11 regions in the state instead of just four. Listeners might remember this anyway. But
there's so many phases and regions and plans and subphases and everything. But where are we heading? I guess that's the key question.
Mitigations and stuff, when we experienced that fall resurgence of COVID. It's become increasingly clear. At that point, we didn't know what the vaccine timeline would look like, but it's become increasingly clear that now that, not everyone, but a lot of folks have been, able to get access to at least the first dose of their vaccines, that life needs to, the reopening plan needs to be readjusted. So what the governor announced was this bridge to phase five, which is pretty much normalcy. So this bridge phase means that, for certain businesses and settings, you would have expanded capacity. Now, in retail settings, we already are at 50% capacity. The bridge phase would only bring us to 60% capacity, not so noticeable. But for things like weddings, where currently the cap is at 50 guests or 50% of, a room's current capacity during normal times, the cap would now be 250 plus folks who are fully vaccinated don't count against that number. So that's a huge difference. And how we get to this bridge phase is a certain amount of folks need to 70%, I believe, need to be vaccinated over age 65. And then we would stay in this bridge phase for at least 28 days for monitoring to make sure that we don't have an explosion in cases. And then we would move to phase five as soon as a certain amount of people 16 and over get vaccinated. But phase five will still not be completely normal. The governor is asking that, or he's going to continue the mask mandate, and he's punting to the CDC to determine when it's going to be safe for everyone to go maskless again.
And you mentioned vaccines, and that's a crucial component here. I think I heard the governor say last week that something like 1% of the adult population is getting a shot every day now. So slowly inching forward there. But he's expanding eligibility for vaccines as well.
That's right. Starting on April 12th, everyone in the state 16 and over is eligible for a shot. And that's a kind of a response to President Joe Biden's demand of states a few weeks back that by May 1st, all adults would become eligible for a shot. What the governor said when he was announcing this was that it's been confusing for folks. That's true. There's a lot of misinformation, disinformation. It's confusing. 1A, 1B, what does that mean? So he hopes that it'll clear it up by making everyone just eligible. But in the meantime, starting today, Monday, the 22nd, I think it is, more folks are going to be eligible. I don't have a list right in front of me, but starting
Members of the
next
media,
Sunday.
for example,
Yes.
certain additional, what do you call it, essential workers, or I guess
Restaurant
somewhat
workers will
essential
become
workers, yeah.
eligible next Monday, and then, that'll carry us in the 2 weeks until April 12th when everyone becomes eligible. But that
Yeah.
doesn't mean that everyone will be able to get shots right away. And, of course, still urging patience on that front.
Yeah, everyone will be able to join the frustration of navigating eight different websites to try and figure out where they can get an appointment to get a shot. Okay, one of the things that we did see change during the pandemic is voting and how our elections are conducted. And Sarah Mancer, you covered last week some legislation that the Illinois House was looking at dealing with elections and voting laws. Can you talk a little bit about what would that do and what's behind it? What might be changing from how the election was conducted last year and what's sort of becoming more permanent?
So a lot of what the state adopted in the 2020 general election will be made permanent if the state Senate passes this measure that was approved in the House last week. And this bill that passed in the House, it makes permanent some of the things like vote by mail, that expansion and curbside voting expansions, those would be adopted. So during the 2020 election, state election authorities had to accept any ballot, regardless if it did not have the correct amount of postage. So that is in this bill. It also, this bill, it would expand the drop boxes. So if election authorities would like to use drop boxes to collect ballots, that is in this. One thing that is not in this is it would not require local election officials to mail or email vote by mail ballot applications to voters who cast a ballot in previous elections. And this had been included in the 2020 general election, but was not extended. And so these measures were adopted. The Democrats said that these measures were useful to local election authorities and local clerks because, it made voting easier for a lot of people who couldn't make it on election day, expanding mail-in ballots and that sort of thing. But Republicans in the House, at least, took issue with a lot of the things in this bill, and they argued that the collection sites need to be more secure and that it may be unfair if local election authorities are able to place drop boxes in more Republican areas or more Democratic areas that might sway the vote. So there was definitely some opposition from the Republicans, but it did pass the House and now it heads to the Senate.
Oh, interesting. So I guess if a county clerk were to put the drop box all over a college campus, say, but not in the neighborhood with all the Trump flags or whatever the 2022 or 24 equivalent of that will be, that they're saying they could sort of slant the election or the ease of voting that way.
Right, because there's no restrictions on where these drop boxes can be placed. So, yes, some county clerk could technically do that.
Interesting. All right. We have, let me just take a moment to reintroduce my guests. They are Sarah Manser, who's a reporter with Capital News Illinois, and Hannah Meisel, who's the State House editor for NPR Illinois and public radio stations across the state, including all the ones on which you are listening to the 21st Now. We are doing our weekly reporters roundtable, talking about some issues that have been coming up in state government, and just about 5 minutes left. So, maybe kind of a bit of a lightning round here. Sarah, I want to ask about another issue you've covered this spring, which is the Illinois law around parental notification for abortions. Given how far in the direction toward abortion rights the Democratic majority in the Illinois General Assembly has gone in recent years, some people might be surprised to learn this is still the law in Illinois. Can you talk just briefly about what's the status there and what do Democrats want to do to change that?
Yeah, this law, parental notification of abortion law, it essentially requires minors, so who are under 18, who wish to have an abortion, they have to notify their parent or legal guardian. It's not necessarily seeking permission, but simply notification. And the Democrats want to repeal this law, saying that it is it will burden some girls who are living in households where their parent or legal guardian would not approve of this, and that it would result in some negative outcome. The law was passed, I guess, initially in 1983, but the current version was passed in 1995, and even though it was on the books since then, it didn't actually take effect until 2013, because it had been tied up in the courts since then. And there are exceptions to this law, so you can seek court permission to not have to ask your parent or not have to notify your parents if you can meet certain conditions. So there are exceptions. But Democrats want to repeal the law, and they have introduced a measure to do so.
Interesting. Well, yeah, and there's such a complicated history here that we don't have time to get into. This law was originally passed during brief Republican control of the General Assembly in the 90s, but wasn't implemented for years because the Illinois Supreme Court wouldn't go along until a more conservative justice became the Chief Justice. But we don't really have time to get into that. In the few minutes we do have remaining, Hannah, I want to ask about one other vote that came up in the Illinois House last week, and this was regarding one of their colleagues, Republican State Representative Chris Miller, who is the spouse of Congresswoman Mary Miller. Can you talk briefly, what was this resolution of condemnation all about?
That's right. Republican Representative Chris Miller, he's one of the more conservative members of the Illinois House, and this is now his second term. He represents Eastern Illinois. His hometown is Oakland. And he was present at that so-called Save America rally on January 6th, the rally that, you know, kind of morphed into this armed insurrection, you know, at the U.S. Capitol. Now, Chris Miller claims that he was not part of the, you know, the part of the day that turned violent. He says that he and his wife were in, you know, Congresswoman Mary Miller's Capitol office, kind of barricaded in there. But he had said on this Facebook Live that he did from that rally that morning, you know, Democrats are terrorists, and, you know, they're fighting a great cultural war to see which side would win. You know, a lot of things that people found offensive, and not just Democrats, but you know, Republicans also. We remember the fallout of January 6th. I don't think anyone will ever forget that. And plenty of Republicans were deeply disturbed by that. And so,
and he had one of those stickers on his car that was the 3%er militia group.
And so about maybe a month ago now, there's a lot of social media sleuths who are combing through video footage of that day. And his truck with, of course, Illinois representative license plates came up, and he has this sticker in that footage that represents this 3%ers group, this paramilitary, anti-government, far-right group. And Chris Miller says that he didn't know what it was, and he's since taken it off his truck. But this resolution to condemn him You know, it doesn't really have any teeth. Nothing really happens to him. But it was very interesting to see how many kind of moderate Democrats refused to vote for it. They didn't vote against it, but, you know, they refused to even participate. Republicans, who it's not like he's very popular within his own caucus, they mostly voted to against it, kind of defending him, saying this condemnation goes too far. And like it or not, this is his right as a person, an American, to have free speech.
Yeah. And we should just maybe in conclusion add that he is also the subject, apparently, of an ethics complaint with the Legislative Inspector General's office. And that is still ongoing, although the way that office operates, we may never know what the resolution is of that case. So unfortunately, that is all the time we have for our roundtable now. So I want to thank my guests. They have been Hannah Meisel, State House Editor at NPR Illinois and public radio stations across the state, and Sarah Manser, who's a reporter with Capital News Illinois. Hannah, Sarah, thanks so much for being with me this Monday morning on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to be talking to the creators of the Illinois-based podcast Black, Brown, and Bilingue. After a short break, this is the 21st. Stay with us.